Dave Cooper joining us in studio. No cell phone.
Nope.
No any of that stuff. Don't even know it. Hey, there's my kind of guy.
You know, and I don't want to hold you up, but I'm dealing with a client on a purchase who has no cell phone. No, I'm sorry. He does have cell phone, but he has no availability of fax or internet.
Okay.
You talk about going back to the horse and buggy days.
Yeah,
it's all a lot of mailing back and snail mail back and forth and back and forth.
It's the old days.
But that's the way it is.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
And Dave Cooper is joining us. He's been on the Roadhouse before. We always enjoy having him here. He's been with the Grand Portage National Monument as the archaeologist, among many other duties that you do up there. Dave, welcome to the Roadhouse again.
Thank you.
Great to have you aboard. We'll, I guess we're doing all right with our distance from the mic there. Thanks. Here you are, after the years that you spent in Grand Portage, you've made a decision to move to Bayfield for work, and then suddenly, just a short time ago, you make a major find in Grand Portage. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Lake Superior is always full of surprises. Doing a rebuild on the park dock, and we've got the maintenance crew out there working, and we started last fall with some archaeological work. We had an underwater team, including divers from Isle Royale National Park and from our national dive team up here working, and we had underwater investigations to make sure we weren't disrupting any part of the old dock or any, you know, dump or shipwreck or anything that might have been part of the old fort there. And so we thought we had things pretty well cleared, but we also knew that the dock cribs themselves could house some interesting surprises, and sure enough, they did. Our maintenance excavator operator, Bob Walker, was really on the ball, and one day he's out there working, removing rock from one of the cribs to replace it, and sees something shiny drop out of the bucket onto the deck of the barge, and he thought, well, this may be interesting, so he shuts down, gets down and look, and it's parts of an old fur trade kettle. So he shut down and called me up, and we get down there and look, and his bucket has scooped up over 100 pieces of hardware from the fur trade that somehow ended up down in the bottom of this old crib. And it's kettle parts, gun parts, different types of hardware, broken tools, just a really oddball collection of stuff. We're standing around scratching our head wondering, you know, what is it and how did it all get in the fill?
Mm-hmm. Now, how long has that dock been there? How long has that crib been there? Do you have any idea?
That particular crib was probably from 1931. And now, we believe there was older dock elements there that they had built on top of, but we don't think that's where this stuff came from. We think somehow this stuff was thrown into the 1931 crib, and we don't know how or why. My theory right now is that part of 1931 work, when they were building this new dock, it was before it was a national monument. It was before even the county or the tribe were running it as a historic site, which started back in the 1930s. There was a private group that was commemorating the fur trade there, and they built a little museum in the area where the old blacksmith shop had been. And it's sort of right near the end of the dock. And then they built this dock as sort of an access point for getting to Isle Royale, amongst other things. So it's my theory that maybe they were cleaning up around this old blacksmith shop and just got a bunch of scrap metal and things that were just laying out in the weeds and probably looked just like junk at the time and threw it all in the fill with the rock. We have no idea, but that's what it looks like, because it's not just fur trade stuff. There's stuff in there from the 1800s and even some early 1900s stuff. And a lot of it's just broken. It's not intact. If it had been a dump from the fort, we would have expected not just metal, but maybe, you know, broken glass, broken ceramics. And we would have expected it spread out across the bottom, not just contained in and around this crib. So that's sort of our theory. It was somebody was doing a little house cleaning and threw all this fur trade era, quote-unquote, junk into this crib. And fortunately, our maintenance operator saw it as it dropped on the deck of the barge and shut down and gave us a call.
Now, it wouldn't seem to me that it'd be so logical that there would be something in a crib other than rocks and, you know, dirt and things to hold that in place. But yet, you are right there ready for something to be there. Is that the case any time that you're digging or exploring on that site?
Yeah, you know, we're right by a 250-year-old fort, archaeological site. There's thousands of years of native use there as well. So we're extremely careful. I mean, even if we're putting a signpost in the ground, we're being extremely careful the whole time. So generally, I'm there either to monitor the work as it's going on, or we actually have archaeological work done in advance. Like when we removed the old parking lot, for example, we had not just archaeological excavation, but geophysics work, which included types of remote sensing that are used for looking through the ground, looking at soil properties such as conductivity and resistivity to see if we can find old building foundations or trenches. We're looking at things with magnetometry to see, you know, you might find a fire hearth or a blacksmith hearth or something like that from the magnetic signature of the soil. So things like that are done routinely at Grand Portage before any kind of construction work is done around the park.
Now, you got to remember that you're talking to Bob and I here. And there was some pretty big words that went by there, Bob.
Did you see how fast we went from Twitter to magnetometry?
It was just bam.
And
like
I don't understand what either of them are.
This world is moving faster than we are, obviously. But it sounds like it's very sophisticated methods that you're using to keep track of what's happening when you do anything there.
Yep. We're very careful. And of course, there's, you know, both state and federal policy on protecting historic resources and environmental protection and all that. So all that comes into play in terms of the work that we do. Mm-hmm. And so in a case like this, we do all the pre-work that we can, but then we're ready for any kind of surprises that might come along as well. So I was able to get in the water right that moment with dive gear and go down and see this material and assess it. You know, is it a shipwreck? Is it a dump? Or is it what we believe it is? It's material fill that's been thrown into the crib.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What will you do next with that? Did you go ahead then and remove all the material that you thought would encompass that?
Most of it ended up in the excavator bucket, so it was already out of the water by the time I got there. So I had a few odds and ends of pieces of old fur trade kettle scrap and things that were still in the bottom. But yeah, it's all been recovered. It's in our lab. We've got a small lab for processing, cleaning, treating artifacts, and a facility for storing and securing them. So that's where they are now. Some of them may need some more treatment than we can provide. We've got a contract firm down in Minneapolis who does some of our work. All the new exhibits up there, a lot of that material went through that Minneapolis lab for treatment, repair.
How do you date that stuff?
That's kind of where we're at right now, is trying to figure out the what's and when's of the materials. There's a lot of study that has been done on fur trade artifacts, and of course, you know, up at the monument, we're just totally into the fur trade. Even if it's broken things, we're totally into it. So some of our staff already have a lot of knowledge in that area. Carl Koster, who you may know, is one of our seasonal interpreters. Steve Veit, and we're fortunate to have Douglas Burke, a fur trade archaeologist, on site when this happened. He was up there doing a separate study of other material. So they have all kinds of literature that they're pulling in, looking at finds in Michigan, finds even in Louisiana, very similar types of, for example, French kettles, maybe from the 1730s, 1750s periods, British types of kettles, British gun parts, various types of blacksmith I guess you call it debris and broken tools and things like that. So we're comparing from a lot of different sources. We don't have, I guess, what you call direct dating methods on this stuff, where you may have a patent mark on it. It's not going to be that easy to have a marked piece, or to radiocarbon date it, which you might do with an organic. So we have to use comparative dating methods, finding things that have been found. Like, let's say they dug a 1780s building at Mackinac Island, and they found that very type of kettles. Part or that type of gun part. And maybe from a combination of those sites, you can kind of infer a date range, 1780s, 1820s. And of course, we know the period that our fort was in use, so some people at other sites are interested in our material for that same purpose. They'll say, well, they found one of these at Grand Portage. Actually, they found five of these at Grand Portage. So there's a whole world of people kind of working on these problems.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I saw the archaeological dig that was going on up the Gunflint Trail here 2-3 years ago or something, and there they have a kind of a layer, and they go down by layers. Now, in this case, oftentimes you're looking at things that have been disturbed and moved.
Right.
And that must complicate things.
Yeah, it's a different kind of archaeology. It's you know, if you look at archaeology almost like analyzing a crime scene, you know, where everything is, you know, where it fell, and you're analyzing a crime scene, quote unquote. Archaeology uses a lot of those same sort of forensic techniques, but in this case, you're looking at a disturbed scene. So where exactly things are may not always be relevant, but it can be. I've worked on sites where, for example, on shipwrecks, where buoyant materials floated up, heavy materials sank. There maybe have been multiple decks in a ship, so you've got layers of things stratified by buoyancy. You can figure out what happened through different means, and that's actually a sub-discipline in archaeology, is actually studying how sites form, you know, using, you know, studies of soil movement and water movement, things like that, to figure out. And some of this, again, is drawn from forensic sciences as well, studying ballistics of ammunition, for example.
Did you have something, Bob?
I did. Just you said that you went, the guy, Bob Walker?
Bob, the excavator.
Called you down there, and you said you found parts of kettles. Were you able to tell right away this is a piece from a kettle?
Yeah.
You were?
Yeah.
Were they large enough to be, or had you just seen that before?
Yeah, we'd seen some of these before. It's common in the fur trade that these trade kettles, which were very common, everybody used them, native people used them quite a bit for, you know, maple sugaring and cooking rice. And they were just very general purpose cooking pots. But they have very classic forms, including where the handle meets the body of the pot. They call it a lug, and there's French-style lugs and British-style lugs and later British lugs that are called Hudson Bay-type kettles. So we immediately recognize, whoa, kettle scrap. Mm-hmm. And many of these things are cut. You can actually see where they've been cut and scrapped. They would remake them. Tinkling cones on powwow dresses, for example, were a common type of reuse of kettle scrap, little decorative things. One reused thing that we actually found in the find from the dock was like a little grain scoop where they'd taken flat kettle scrap, folded up the corners of it, and just created a little metal scoop. And we have other things like that that have been found in the park as well, little small scoops, a little grater, like something that might have been used for grating spice. Mm-hmm. They took metal nails, square nails, punched holes through it, made a little grater. So it's interesting how very, you know, thrifty people were on the frontier with this material. Was, you know, metal wasn't as easy as going down to Bucks and just buying the stuff. So they would reuse and scrap everything that they could. And a blacksmith shop, of course, would have had all this kind of scrap laying around waiting to be reused.
Hmm. Are you, in this case, this happened because you were doing something else?
Right, dock construction. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you proactive as far as looking for things as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We've since I've been there, we've been working quite a bit looking at archaeological sites throughout the whole park. In particular, stuff that's not been explored, areas that haven't been explored, the main trail area, looking at watering holes and encampment areas, rest stops, the sort of the use of the portage itself, and it was used prior to European arrival, so there's very ancient evidence there that we're interested in. There's much later use after the fur trade. Some of the early mines in the boundary water areas were actually supplied across there, so we've even found mining tools. Of course, loggers used the portage, hunters, trappers. There's all sorts of different personalities that, you know, we're finding on the trail. We found British Army buttons from the Revolutionary War. We found Civil War era Army buttons. We think from, there was a U.S. Army survey working up here in 1861, doing a lake survey. We're trying to get out in front and really understand the whole history of the place.
Now, I know for listeners that didn't know this before, if you really want to feel, and this is my feeling from walking up it, feel history right beneath your feet is to hike up the Grand Portage Trail.
Yeah. You see the old wagon ruts and the old pine, just, you know, there's trees up there that are as old as the fur trade. You can see things that are alive at the time that trail was in use as a fur trade route.
Mm-hmm. I ran up it here before you were, I think slightly before you were on the last time we talked about that. And
that's, black flies,
was,
right?
Was, yeah, they're still there. It doesn't matter how old the trail is.
Some of those black flies, I understand it, were there. And,
yeah, I think the same
for training
ones,
times too, yeah.
They're still taking chunks out. But yeah. You must have done extensive work up by Fort Charlotte and in that area. Was that part of your... realm?
We've done some work up there. There was a lot of work done up there in the 1970s, and we're doing a little bit of follow-up. Again, particularly areas that we were concerned about, where the park may be doing some work and we don't want to disturb any archaeological remains. So, for example, improvements to the campsites are involving some archaeological work. We're also setting up long-term monitoring for Fort Charlotte to make sure that that site is preserved long-term. So we're documenting things and setting up areas that we can monitor long-term for things like erosion and that sort of thing, different types of impacts that might be threatening the site.
Well, in your case, because of the site up there, because of the history there, you're expecting to find things like that. It kind of amazes me that I always wonder how many times things like that are just scooped up. Anywhere around this area, Minneapolis area, wherever it happens to be, they're just gone forever because nobody's really looking for history beneath the ground that they're digging on.
Yeah, and that was one really cool part of this story, was having an excavator operator who was really just on the ball and really cared about, you know, he's working around this historic site. And, you know, if he hadn't said anything, that stuff would have just been hauled off in the trash. So I think it's a good story, not just for Grand Portage, but also that, you know, you never know when that kind of person could help really save an important find anywhere else around the state.
Can you talk a little bit for the folks listening, we don't have a lot of time, but we do have some, about what people can see at the monument in Grand Portage as far as the finds that you've already established?
Yeah.
In the new building?
Yep. The new visitor center opened in 2007, and we have really a nice set of exhibits there on the archaeology and the history of the park. So a lot of the material that was recovered there, excavated starting in the 1930s, is on exhibit, and examples of very similar things, fur trade kettles, knives, buttons, all the things that might have been traded with native people or that fur traders themselves might have had in their, you know, personal possession. We've got a lot of that on exhibit, talking about the science of archaeology, but there's also a lot in there just on the history of the community and the Ojibwa people there. There's really beautiful examples of beadwork, quill work, some of it fairly old, going back to the 1800s. A lot of pictures of community members. You can even listen to oral histories from community members on audio programs. There's a little interactive where you can play the part of an Ojibwa hunter who's trading with a French clerk, who, and you're going to try and get the best of them in the fur trade. So it's a little interactive there. So, yeah, a lot of stuff. And this summer we're going to be filming a new park film. So we'll have a film team up here during the rendezvous in August, and they'll be shooting basically for a new orientation film for visitors. And of course, we have the whole reconstructed fort with the costumed interpreters that folks may have visited in the past. There's a lot, of course, to see. And we've announced we're not charging fees this year. Free, little our response to economic stimulus, get people up there to visit. So it's never been a better time to come up and learn about some of Cook County's history and native heritage.
And as I mentioned early on in the interview, you're taking a new challenge on, moving to the Bayfield area to do similar work.
Right.
Down there.
Right. There's a big lighthouse restoration project going in the Apostle Islands. So I'm going down to start work on that, and also to be doing some very similar archaeological work in the Apostle Islands. So it's kind of a bittersweet thing for me to be leaving this area I really, really have gotten to love, but I'm not moving too far, and we're keeping a foothold here, and
yes.
I'm sure I'll be back.
We look forward to that, and we look forward to talking to you at some point, you know, and as you vacation back and forth here, we'll see you down in the harbor.
And I hope to see you on the South Shore.
Keep your radio at 90.7. Anyway.
I will, yeah, absolutely.
And it will
absolutely
work there. We've been speaking with Dave Cooper, and Dave was with the archaeologist with the Grand Portage National Monument. We want to thank him so much for joining us here tonight. And as he mentioned, you can see a lot of Dave's endeavors out in Grand Portage at the new visitor center, and it's a fascinating place to go.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It sure is. Well, thank you again, Dave.